Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Welcome to Science in Action from the BBC World Service with me, Roland Pease. We've two looming food crises this week. In a moment, the precarious state of fish stocks worldwide, which we so depend on for protein. And later, the adaptable fungus that's destroying banana plantations across the planet. We've also the first results from India's daring moon mission a year ago. And scientists love to get published, but they seem to hate the publishing houses that share the results. What chance of a reconciliation? But first, those fish. According to the latest report of the Food and Agriculture Organization, we each eat on average about 20 kilos of fish and seafood each year. It's an incredibly important part of the diet in many coastal communities, and in previous decades, there was a reasonable fear that we were fishing so hard we'd leave too few fish in the seas to breed the next generation. So they introduced fisheries management, and after a time we thought the crisis was sorted. But a study just out in Science magazine has reanalysed data from 230 fisheries around the world and says fish stocks are in a far worse state than we've been told. The number of fisheries with fewer than the critical number of spawning females has been undercounted, and many have far fewer spawning females than was previously projected. So while I'd been under the impression, like a lot of us, that fish management was a problem largely fixed, marine conservationist Rainer Fröser has never been happy and says the new analysis confirms his fears.
The question is, how much can you take out as catch from a fish stock without hurting it, without shrinking it too much? And that can be calculated for every stock, and it's roughly 20% of what is in the water you can take out year after year after year, and it will regrow through somatic growth, I mean increase in body weight, and new fish joining the parent stock. So 20% per year, and here comes the problem, because the 80% have to stay in the water, but they are visible, they are catchable. You can make a windfall profit if you go after them. And this temptation is just too big for politicians and many others to not fall to. But unregulated fisheries will eventually collapse. So there is no way around it. What we now have is in developed countries, and that's what the study relates to, that science basically calculates how much you can take from a stock, and then they calculate how big is the stock next year. And if you combine these two insights, then you get the maximum sustainable catch for next year. That's basically what they give the politicians at hand, and they then decide how much can be caught, or how big can the fleet be, or how long can the catch season be.
This has been going on for at least 30 years in terms of intensive management of these fish stocks, but this paper seems to be saying the calculations are often wrong and essentially too optimistic.
Yeah, now if you have set the right rate, say you can take out your 20% per year, okay, and everybody agrees, and that's then in the papers and what have you not, that sounds fine, but the catch that comes from that, the catch representing these 20%, is a proportion then of the biomass that is in the water. And here comes the problem. The biomass that will be in the water next year has been vastly overestimated, especially in stocks that were in trouble. And the overestimation was partly 100%. And that if you do that and you calculate the 20% that you can take sustainably from a wrongly estimated stock that is estimated much higher than it actually is, well, then basically you take out twice of what the stock can reproduce, and then you're in trouble. And that is happening not once, but regularly, and not in one stock, but on average in all stocks.
Where's the problem coming? I presume at one level we know that, for example, I make up the number, a million tons of cod have been fished from some part of the Atlantic. Do I base my estimate of how much has been left behind somehow on that number? Do I have an independent measure? How good is that measure? And then again, how good is the understanding of how that will lead to next year's stock?
Now, fishery science is working well if the data are available and correct. And so over time, more and more data come in, and then you know the close to true size of the stock in hindsight. After 2, 3, 4 years, you know how big it really was. But for fisheries management, you have to make a prediction. How big will the stock be next year? And you have no data on that yet. You can only make assumptions, basically. And these assumptions have been grossly wrong. And we know that 3, 4 years later, you look at that year for which the prediction was made, turns out the real stock size when data came in was much smaller. Now, you can make such mistake once or twice, but year after year after year, then the question arises, why have they not corrected this error? And that is the thing that also is speculated about in the paper. You don't really know, right? But they assume that the expectations or the pressure on scientists to allow the highest possible catches leads to the fact that then they tend to be over-optimistic, and that is reflected in the predictions. Now, one of the solutions we propose is that actually you have to use simpler models that are not prone to such big errors. If you have up to 40 parameters settings in a model, then you have no clue anymore what settings really determine the outcome. And if the outcome is wrong, which one of the settings were wrong? Or was it a combination of settings?
I mean, it sort of suggests that somehow they're not picking on the important parameters, the important one, which might be the number of breeding females or the state of the ocean or something like that. That there are really important things, but by having sort of irrelevant details in there, they're allowing the models to get it wrong.
Exactly. And some of the parameters you can't even estimate. You have to more or less put in values that you guess, make a best guess. And this best guess then is very much tainted by your expectations. And if your expectations are that the stock shall grow, even if we overfish it, it shall recover, which is a bit of a fantasy, well, then that will be reflected in the outcome of the model, the way you set the parameters that went in.
I suppose what I'm wondering is this going to require some severe cuts in fisheries in the coming few years to make sure that there's something sustainable in the long term? Or is it going to be a slower adjustment?
Well, let me say very provocatively, the catch levels that were allowed, basically, I mean, if there had been no fisheries management, no catch levels set, nothing would have changed. No fish more would have been taken out of the water because the fishers were taking as much as they could economically take out already. And they could not reach the allowed catch levels with that. Now, the question is, will then catches have to be restricted more? Well, in some cases, yes, but we're talking here mostly about depleted stocks that are in urgent need of recovery. And let me say something else. Most of our stocks are highly productive. The 3, 4 year old fish, like cod or others, they double their body weight in 1 year. 100% more body weight if you live them 1 year longer. So our stocks can recover, if you let them, within 2, 3, 4 years. They can be at the right stock size, and catches then can be much higher than they are now. Let me put it otherwise. Of all the problems that the oceans face, like plastic and warming and acidification and lack of oxygen and what have you not, overfishing is the one that can be fixed fastest and easiest. All you have to do is stop subsidies. If you stop subsidies to fishing, immediately, a lot of overfishing is not economically feasible anymore. Stocks will then recover, and because there is fewer fishing, and everybody will benefit. So the madness of overfishing that's going on is only possible because of massive subsidies to it. If they stop, things will get immediately better. We only have to have the political will to finally fix fisheries.
Rainer Fröser of the Helmholtz Center of Ocean Research in Germany. His commentary and the original research are both available at sciencemag.org. About this time last year, the Indian Space Research Organization ISRO was achieving a spectacular feat, landing a space probe Vikram and robotic rover Pragyan on the moon's surface, closer to the prized lunar South Pole than any effort so far.
Yeehaw.
No wonder they were delighted. The problems that more established spacefarers like NASA in the States and Japan's JAXA, the problems they've been having with lunar landings underline the significance of India's achievement. And like the Apollo missions of the 60s, closer to the moon's equator, the scientific aim of this one includes understanding the moon's minerals so that we can get a better understanding of its origins. The first results confirm that billions of years ago, molten rock, a magma ocean, covered the moon as far south as the Chandrayaan 3 landing site, as shown by an X-ray detector called APXS, overseen by principal investigator Santosh Vadwale.
Our instrument is on the rover, Alpha Particle X-ray Spectrometer, and basically what we are trying to look is the elemental composition of a lunar surface. And wherever the rover goes, we were sitting there, we were all stationed there for next 12 days because the rover operations were literally 24/7 going on. So what we use is what you call X-ray fluorescence spectroscopy, and there is another process called particle-induced X-ray emission. So what happens is when any element, when they're excited by this incoming radiation, either X-rays or alpha particles, they emit what is known as the characteristic X-rays, which are kind of fingerprint for each element.
They're a bit like the colors of elements with visible light, but these are with X-rays.
Yes, but it's in X-rays. We want to measure the energy of these X-rays and also count how many X-rays of a particular energies are there. If we can count how many X-rays of given energies are there, then we will be able to eventually correlate that with the local concentration of those elements and then to constrain the abundances. So for that, we use this very sophisticated X-ray detectors. For excitation of these elements, we require a radioactive source for which we carry this radioactive source called curium-244. It emits both X-rays and alpha particles.
And so the rover is basically, it's got this little radioactive source that's bombarding the dust on the surface of the moon, and then you're looking at the X-rays that come shining out. And that's the way that you're telling the amount of silicon and iron and these kinds of elements are there.
Yes.
How did you choose the landing site to understand the history of the moon?
Everybody wants to go as close as possible to the pole. This particular area, which is the lunar highland, it does have significance in terms of its geological characteristics. So that is why this was selected. So geologically, this site is very interesting.
When you say interesting geologically, is it because it's thought to be a very old part of the lunar surface? It hasn't been changed.
Highlands are the oldest form rocks on the moon. So that was the another point which actually we could also confirm, because as per the prevailing kind of theory, you can say, or hypothesis, where which is with this lunar magma ocean hypothesis. Very early phase of a moon's evolution, moon was kind of fully molten. And then as the magma solidifies the topper layer crust, it forms this highland rock, which is obviously an orthostatic rock. When you come to very high latitude, like this southern point, I mean, so there it was important to get these in situ observations and see whether this confirms to this lunar magma ocean hypothesis or not. So that was what our another important point, that when we see the elemental composition and when we convert it into the kind of mineral composition, we find that it is fully dominated by the rock type, what is called ferro-anorthosites, which is one of the key predictions for the magma ocean hypothesis.
The lunar magma ocean is a very evocative phrase, but this is basically the idea that instead of having liquid water over the surface, the rocks on the whole surface were basically liquid rock. Magma, and then as it cooled, it crystallizes, and those are the crystals that you're actually detecting now.
So when it cools, the point is that heavier crystals, like magnesium and iron-bearing minerals like olivine, pyroxene, they are expected to go sink deeper, and then the lighter crystal, lighter rocks like these phenocentric rocks, they are supposed to be floating over it. So that is why we expect it to be primarily made up of a fan, which is what we are finding.
Santosh Vadwale of India's Physical Research Laboratory in Ahmedabad, and he's a PI on the critical APXS machine.
CrowdScience takes your questions about life, Earth and the universe, and goes in search of answers.
I've become a guinea pig.
Can I confirm that you can't see anything?
I think it might be the first time I've touched a snake.
If it's interesting, we investigate.
We have the technology and the know-how to do it.
Whoa! Okay, blinding light as you open that.
CrowdScience from the BBC World Service.
I was
just wondering what the science might be behind that.
This is like nothing I have ever experienced.
Very strange indeed.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Those first results from India's Chandrayaan mission were just published by Nature, one of the publishing giants in science. Go to Nature's website, and unless you're a subscriber, you'll find they'll ask you to pay £15 for the privilege of reading it. Other papers there are open access, meaning they are free to read. Because the science is covered up front, Nature's costs for reviewing the paper and getting it formatted, getting the figures made to Nature standards, and so on and so on. Ever since the Royal Society instructed its secretary Edmund Halley, he of Comet fame, to pay personally for the printing of Newton's Principia, outlining those famous laws of motion, who pays has been a painful question in science publishing. The traditional model of publishers recouping their costs by charging a subscription became an expensive barrier to readers, especially outside Europe and North America. Hence the move to open access, at least for some papers, with researchers instead bearing the costs up front. But those costs are now collectively draining billions from their research budgets, according to a preprint yet to be refereed by Stephanie Haustein.
So the problem with open access wasn't the idea of open access. And when open access came to be in the early 2000s, one of the Budapest Declaration, open access is really famous and had already its 20 years anniversary. A couple of years ago, the idea wasn't about, oh, now we'll just put the cost on the author, right? Because that would be excluding people now not from reading, but from publishing. So why do we now have these horrendous article processing charges or APCs that are often several thousand dollars per paper? So thousands of dollars that the author needs to pay to even publish. Why do we have that? Because there are a lot of publishers there. Actually, not that many that are very powerful. So they are for-profit companies, and they used to make their money through keeping up the paywall and charging libraries. And we actually had a serials crisis, it was called, since the 1970s, where the subscription costs for the journals would rise faster than inflation, and libraries couldn't afford it anymore, which was another motivation for open access. And then they said, okay, we have to switch the model. So if you want readers to have access for free, then we're going to charge authors. So open access, in my opinion, was kind of perverted by these for-profit companies who now put a huge price tag, a price tag that's completely disconnected from the amount that it costs to produce an academic paper. Because you have to remember that us researchers, we don't get paid to publish, and we also voluntarily do peer review. So that's the quality control for the journal and the gatekeeping. All of that is supplied for free to the publisher. So they do have some costs. Publishing is not completely, you know, you can do it digitally with less costs, but it still costs a little bit of money. But they're now slapping these price tags on 3,000, 5,000. We now know this with Nature, over 12,000 American dollars for one article. And that is completely disconnected from the actual cost.
And as you show in this paper, those $1,000 contributions add up to an awful lot of money over a year.
Billions. In our study, we tried to estimate the amount of money spent globally on these so-called article processing charges. But it's actually not trivial to do this because it's a very intransparent business. So only the publishers really know how much money they're making from the different income sources. And open access, we know, is growing. And so we tried to estimate based on the number of articles published in the last 5 years and what we know they're charging for each of these papers. So some journals charge just a couple hundred dollars. It's very common. Between $2,000 and $3,000 is kind of the average. Some charge way more. But we gathered this information for 8,000 journals over 5 years. And it's also really important to have this information on an annual basis because we do see that those costs tend to go up. So we try to calculate, but it's really important to emphasize that it's really an estimate. We estimated that just last year in 2023, it was over $2.5 billion that the global
billion.
Community...
You billion. Almost swallowed that word, billion.
Yes, billion, yeah. And that was just six publishers. So we didn't even have the information for all publishers in the world. We had the five biggest, and then also in addition, we had PLOS, which is an open access only publisher.
Public Library of Science.
Public Library of Science, yes. And so we had the information for Elsevier, Springer Nature, Wiley, MDPI, and Frontiers. MDPI and Frontiers are companies that publish only open access, so they haven't been around when it was still print. While Elsevier, Springer Nature, Wiley, they're pretty big publishers that have been around for quite a while, and they're making this transition to open access, and they're all making it with this article processing charge, so the author pays business model. There are a lot of actually other models to finance open access, but obviously the for-profit publishers are really good in making profit, so they're focusing on the EPC model.
I mean, it's a really interesting ecosystem, and it's something we've looked at for a long time on Science in Action. A lot of our listeners are in parts of the world where they used to say, we can't afford to read your research, Americans, Europeans, Japanese, and so on. And now they're saying we can't afford to publish our research because of these fees. So it seems to somehow have backfired, this idea.
Yeah, it's really been a problem because now there are actually authors that get excluded from publishing because they can't afford it. And if you think about, I always like to give the example, there's an author publication, article publication charge of $3,000, I could hire a student for the summer, right? Or I could buy a nice computer. So these are kind of the trade-offs that researchers have to make because they mostly pay this from their research money. So this is the budgets they get to do research. And these now often include or have to include the fees to publish, or they have to make these trade-offs of like, yeah, do I hire the student for another semester or do I publish this paper?
But the fact is that academics, for the sort of structural purposes of the way the academic life works, they still need to get publications in some of these journals you're talking about, Nature, some of the Wiley journals and so on. That's how they get progression. And they could go on strike, but they won't.
Yeah, so I think that's the main issue. And that's also what the publishers are taking advantage of. As you said, they go where their money is, and they tend to increase these fees because they can, because researchers still want to publish in these journals because it's so important for their career. Because if you're trying to apply for a tenure track position, for a lecture position and so on, people look at your CV and look where you have published, unfortunately. So it has a lot to do with the brand name of the journal rather than the quality or content of the study. And it's getting, like, this has been kind of inflated in a sense that now I hear, you know, it used to be okay if you want to get a great postdoc position, you have to show where you publish. And now it's even students saying, oh, even to get into a PhD program, you already have to show where you publish during a master's. So it's just getting more and more pressure. And this is because we're really basing the academic reward system on publications. That's why researchers still play ball in a sense. They continue to try to get into these journals, and the publishers take advantage of owning the brand name so they can charge the price they want. So they're charging what authors are willing to pay and not what it costs to publish.
Stephanie Haustein of the School of Information Studies at Ottawa University. Of course, the publishers do see the issue in a different light, and we contacted two of them for their response to the interview. Elsevier, one of the giants of the industry, stressed the high quality and large number of papers that they publish, adding that,
we make openly available information related to our pricing policies on our website. We set pricing based on strict criteria which is applied to open access articles only, which includes journal quality, the journal's editorial and technical processes, competitive and market considerations.
Spring and Nature, I worked there some time back, I should add for transparency, they responded,
publishing and disseminating trusted science is a community enterprise involving a huge network of individuals, each playing their role. We invest heavily in people and tech capabilities to make this process as straightforward as possible. Where article processing charges are higher, such as with Nature, this is because the charge includes the additional costs of the highly specialised editorial and art teams that work on the paper alongside the costs involved in the many articles the Nature journals assess but do not select for publication.
Springer Nature also underlined their
transformative agreements where authors don't pay, and an extensive waiver policy for those in low-income countries, which also includes our Nature Fund for publication in the Nature titles.
I think we should give the whole debate a deeper look sometime. We started the programme with the fish crisis, and we're finishing with a banana crisis, one we have talked about on Science in Action before, but it keeps getting worse. It's down to a fungus called Fusarium oxysporum, to be precise. One strain of this fungus, called Race 1, had already wiped out the staple Gros Michel variety of bananas half a century ago. And now, the replacement Cavendish variety, planted worldwide because it was thought to be resistant to the wilt disease, is succumbing too. It seems breeders hadn't counted on the adaptability of Fusarium fungus species, a subject which captivates geneticist Li Zhengma, with the result that plantations across the planet are succumbing to it.
There are some wilting symptoms reported in Taiwan in 1989, but the disease spread very fast. It quickly got into Australia, Malaysia, Philippines, China, and in 2013, it was started to discover in Mozambique. By 2019, it was reported in Colombia. 2021, reported in Peru. Basically, every place banana are producing.
It's basically threatening the kind of banana crops we have worldwide now, is it, in the short term?
Correct.
So one of the problems is that the Cavendish bananas, they're all clonal cuttings, as it were, of each other. So they're all identical genetically, which makes them very susceptible. And presumably that's also essentially how it spreads, because the cuttings are shared worldwide.
You made perfect understanding of the problem. So plant-fungal interaction, it's a very intimate process between the two parties. Plants have very good resistance. Plants can defend themselves. But pathogen always finding ways to overcome plants' resistance. So once that established, and if you have only the same defense mechanism, if the pathogen finding ways to overcome that resistance, it just spread, have no other means to control it.
Now, my understanding from your paper is it's been very hard to understand why this particular version of the Fusarium fungus is deadly to the plants. And so you've actually just gone in and looked at the genetics to try and get the clues from there.
Yes. For longest time, we was wondering what happened between the 1950s pathogen to today's pathogen. What happened? How did it change? So therefore, we did a very comprehensive comparative study. We collect the samples all around the world. We kept some of the pathogens causing disease in 1950s versus the ones causing disease today. Two things we learned from this study. One is that evolutionarily, this new pathogen not just gradually changed from the older one. So new one actually evolved pretty independently. This pathogen, if I could say the TR4, it's a new pathogen, even though they are under same name, Fusarium oxysporum.
I get the impression from your work this is a very clever fungus, that it can just borrow genes from other places, and that's what it's done in this case.
Yes, I like the word you put. This group of pathogens, there are hundreds of them, they could infect 100 different plants. How they do that is they keep part of the genome to do the basic things like growing, taking nutrient and growth. And the other part is try to interact with specific host. For TR4 pathogen, they secured a group of proteins, genes, and we call them accessory genes. This group of genes, if you remove them from the fungus no longer able to kill the banana host. So how do this group of proteins interact with the host causing disease? As you use the word clever, this group of proteins, they produce kind of a gas we call nitro oxide. We observe a clear nitro oxide burst when the pathogen interacts with the host.
The trouble is, you seem to have found what the problem is, but it sounds so deep-rooted. Is there a way of tackling it? What can farmers do? Can they protect the banana plants from this nitrogen oxide?
I don't think we could directly tell farmers what to do. The process is deep inside the cell in the plant tissue. However, scientists could do transgenic bananas. They are resistant to TR4. They are also, right now, there are some selected banana varieties. They can tolerate TR4 without just let TR4 kill it. That is one active way The other way is introduce diversity of different bananas.
Li Jingma, plant and fungus geneticist at the University of Massachusetts. The multinational study was just published by Nature Microbiology. Go to the Science in Action webpage on bbcworldservice.com for links to more on all the items this week. I'm Ronan Pease, the producer is Jonathan Blackwell. Please join us again same time next week.
Crowd Science takes your questions about life, Earth and the universe and goes in search of answers.
I've become a guinea pig. Can I confirm that you can't see anything?
I think it might be the first time I've touched a snake.
If it's interesting, we investigate.
We have the technology and the know-how to do it.
Whoa! Okay, blinding light as you open that.
Crowd Science from the BBC World Service.
I was just wondering what the science might be behind that.
This is like nothing I have ever experienced.
Very strange indeed.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.